supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. The massive tax code changes pushed by GOP members of Congress could rest on representatives in the Philadelphia suburbs. Many area Republicans are considering how the House and Senate proposals will play in their swing districts as an election year approaches. WHYY's Dave Davies caught up with Representative Pat Meehan, a Republican who represents parts of Delaware, Chester, Montgomery, Berks, and Lancaster counties, and asked how he's approaching the tax plan.
Do you expect to vote for this? I mean, you don't know a final version yet, but could you see any circumstances under which you wouldn't?
Well, there could be circumstances under which I wouldn't, but I think I'm inclined. I'm certainly a member of the Ways and Means Committee and played a role in helping to prepare the House version. So we'll go down into conference. I'm very interested in a provision that relates to the continuation of energy credits, which is important to our region and battery manufacturers in our area. I was able to get that provision in the House version. It's not in the Senate, and it's something that I'm going to continue to pay attention to.
Okay. What about, you know, people are losing their deduction for state and local income and sales taxes. There is a property tax provision there. Is that going to be a problem?
Well, first, the standard deduction has been doubled, and estimates for the Joint Committee that testified before us that almost 94% of families are going to file simply by taking the standard deduction. In addition, with the child tax credits, it's going to put the greatest majority of the people in our area in a positive situation with regard to their taxes. For Pennsylvania, I think we're better off than New York and New Jersey because we were able to get that $10,000 ceiling on the property tax question, which was very, very important to us. So again, the vast majority of homeowners in our district will end up in a positive situation.
Until a few years under the Senate version when a lot of this stuff expired.
Well, that's, look, in 5 years they're going to be phasing out, which is all a function of the way you've got to make bills pass in Washington, D.C., and it has a lot to do with the 10-year window of budget cycles. There's every expectation the commitments that have been made to individuals will be continued beyond the five-year period.
Okay. You've seen these polls that show this as very unpopular. Does that concern you?
Well, I don't think it's very unpopular. No. I think a lot of people don't understand what it will do. I think there's going to be two impacts. First, again, the vast majority of people are going to end up in a positive situation, some significantly. Second, it is misrepresented that this is, you know, not progressive. In fact, in a per capita basis, people in the lower middle standard actually get a larger percentage of their taxes back than the wealthy. In the end, the commitment is really to kickstarting our economy and getting the ability for us to jumpstart investment. And I think we're going to have a real impact on driving the economy as a result of this.
So many moving parts of this. We mentioned, you know, the local tax exemptions. Are there any other things that you think need to be fixed from the Senate version or the House version?
Well, I'm looking at another provision as well. I want to see the deduction for health care expenses continue to be able to be done. It affects seniors in my district. Those who are with chronic diseases or, you know, may have long-term care situations, and even though they may not be with substantial income like they did in a previous part of their life, they've learned to rely on that deduction. And I think it's important, and I'm going to continue to fight to see if we can get that in.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies speaking with Republican Congressman Pat Meehan. Coal miners were some of President Donald Trump's staunchest supporters in the 2016 election. He promised to bring back jobs in the industry, and that promise is heartening some in coal country. State Impact Pennsylvania's Reed Frazier found coal miners who are sticking with the industry instead of looking for a new career.
At a gymnasium in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania, Trenton Phillips is looking for a job as a coal miner.
Yeah, I'm currently looking for something where I can advance, maybe one day be somewhere higher up and not have to break my back and use my head a little more.
Phillips already works at a company that fixes belt lines at coal mines. He's at a job fair in Greene County today where there are booths for jobs in industries like healthcare and trucking. But Phillips is only stopping at a booth for a coal mine contractor. He wants to become a mine foreman or supervisor. Phillips is 24. He got a job at a union coal mine after graduating high school 6 years ago. With overtime pay, he says he made up to $90,000 a year.
It was pretty much booming when I was coming right out of high school, so it seemed like the thing to do.
The mine closed in 2015, so Phillips drove a truck in the oil and gas industry for a year. But the hours were unpredictable, and when a job opened up at the Belt Repair Company, he grabbed it. He says he's not afraid of another coal industry slump now that President Trump is in the White House. Trump has made reviving the coal industry a signature goal of his, and many coal miners are taking this promise to heart.
Now everything seems to be going back up, and it's going in the right direction.
The coal industry has rebounded a bit. This has more to do with foreign demand and rising natural gas prices than any of President Trump's pro-coal policies. That's according to Dan Klein of S&P Global Platts, a company that analyzes energy trends.
There's been very little measurable impact of what the administration has done. And to be honest, there's very little that could be done.
That's because low natural gas prices should continue to keep the market for coal weak. Coal production is up this year, but it's still not close to the level it was at when Phillips first started working in the industry in 2011. And the Department of Energy says coal demand will remain more or less flat the next couple of years. But at least in Pennsylvania, there are plenty of coal miners who are optimistic coal is coming back.
I believe that's what people think.
Amy Gatz is with Southwest Pennsylvania's Workforce Development Board. Her agency got federal funding to retrain 750 laid-off miners, but only 220 have signed up. One reason why so few applied is that miners can't afford to go back to trade school without drawing a paycheck. But the idea of a coal rebound is also a factor, she says.
I would say the sense is that it's going to come back, but from the workforce perspective, we're kind of told it's not ever going to come back to where it was.
The long-term outlook for coal is part of the reason why Elton Ray Hall isn't looking to go back underground. At a McDonald's near Pittsburgh, Ray Hall takes a lunch break from his job with a national lawn care company, where he's a lead technician on a small crew. He earns around $40,000 a year, close to what he made working as a contractor in coal mines. He left the industry 5 years ago when he suffered a bad hernia pulling on a heavy chain. Since then, the coal industry has slumped. Big time.
I've watched 3 of my family members lose their job with the coal mines. And the coal companies they work for say, oh, we'll get you back, we'll get you back, we'll get you back.
They never did get their jobs back. Ray Hall says coal mining has done a lot of good.
I know what this country is built on. I'll never forget that. The times are changing. And for me to be successful in my life, I had to change with it. But not knowing if I have a job was one of them. I know I have a job.
Lawn care offers steady work. And now, Ray Hall says, he's up for a promotion to management with more responsibilities and more pay. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The Kimmel Center in Philadelphia has tapped a new round of artists for its jazz residency programs. 3 musicians will spend several months working on compositions pertaining to social justice to premiere in May. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports.
A historical marker here at the corner of Germantown Avenue and Wister Street in Philadelphia describes the earliest protest against American slavery. It was a document written by Quakers in 1688.
I'm a Quaker, so for me, this is really sacred space.
This is Colton Weatherston, a jazz guitarist, and he is inspired by the different cultures living side by side on Germantown Avenue. Next to this Quaker marker is a halal pizza shop, and across the street is a store selling headscarves worn by Muslim women. As a resident musician at the Kimmel Center, Weatherston wants to explore cross-cultural communication along Germantown Avenue.
We can't close ourselves off from other faith traditions. We would, in effect, be closing ourselves off from maybe learning something about the meaning of life. So the fact that there are other kinds of faiths in the world is kind of intrinsic to my experience of being Quaker.
Weatherston and the other resident jazz musicians at the Kimmel Center get a small stipend plus space and time to realize their ambitions, and they get access to the center's vast network of artists and resources. Pianist Luke Carlos O'Reilly wants to use his residency to create a music and dance piece related to the Black Lives Matter movement. He's a black man, he's large, and he's muscular. And he says because of that, he was violently and unjustly attacked by a Philadelphia police officer in 2008. He contested the officer in court.
He was thrown out of court because the police officer didn't show up. But I left with abrasions and bleeding, and I was struck by a nightstick while I was on the ground and in handcuffs.
O'Reilly wants to collaborate with a choreographer to create a song cycle and performance that addresses the Black Lives Matter movement and his own experience.
It's tough because as a Christian, I try to let go of anger. And just as a human, you know, it's not good for us to hold on to those kind of emotions. But it does, when I think about it, when I'm reminded of it, the thought of it does bring back emotions. And one of the songs that I wrote does tap into it because the song I wrote, it has anger. And you can tell that there's anger in it.
The third artist selected for the Kimmel residency, Doug Hillinger, plans a song cycle about gentrification. He says he will work with an ensemble that includes the poet Ursula Rucker. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Even before the first day of winter, we have our first indication that spring is just around the corner. Joining me in conversation is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Astronomer or meteorologist? What's the forecast?
I'm going to go for a blend of the two because sometimes it requires a little bit of astronomy to help the meteorology along, if you will. In this case, it's our rapid run now, as I like to say, towards spring.
Yay.
We're slowly getting there, believe it or not, and it may seem unusual to talk about it this way, but we are approaching the winter solstice coming up in just a couple of weeks, but our first hint that we're really getting there is that we have our earliest sunset this week, which is very cool at 4:35 p.m. tonight and then for the next couple of days. So while it may seem to be depressing that it's gotten so dark so early, the upside of this is that in another week or so, sunset is going to slip by a minute back to 4:36 in the afternoon. Well, not much. It's a hint of what's to come because sunsets will continue to come later and later as we make our trek toward winter solstice. Now, we get to winter solstice, which, of course, is identified as this particular day of the year in which we have the fewest number of hours and minutes of daylight for the course of the year. However, following closely on the heels of winter solstice in early January, we'll come to perihelion just in the first week of January, and then we'll really start to see gains on the day because shortly thereafter, we will have reached the latest sunrise of the year, early January, about 7:20 or so. And then we'll start to pile on the minutes both in the morning at sunrise and in the evening at sunset. And lo and behold, the next thing you know, we'll be in T-shirts and shorts again.
Can't wait.
I'm trying to make it as optimistic getting through winter as possible.
Well, one potential advantage of these dark skies, any chance of seeing a cigar-shaped interloper from outer space?
Freud famously said a cigar is just a smoke. And in this case, for us, it's actually an asteroid. And this is an unusual asteroid, not only because of its shape. It's 10 times longer than it is wide. But this object appears to be, based on its shape, its reflectivity, and its non-reaction to its close flyby of the sun, it's been ruled out as a comet. But the cool thing about it is that it seems to be from another solar system entirely. And this is a very new kind of thing for us. And it's not to say that objects from other solar systems could not possibly wander somehow over to our solar system. But this is the first time we've had an opportunity to examine such an object with the kind of astronomical research tools that we have.
Here's another oddity. It's the anniversary of an attack of a meteorite.
Yes, it is kind of this very, very unusual sort of anniversary. Just recently, we celebrated the 132nd anniversary of the first photo of a meteor shower that took place in 1885. In 1954, though, Elizabeth Hodges was struck by a ricocheting meteorite in her home in Alabama. Of course, we can go back in history thousands of years and find recordings in various ways that there have been meteor showers and things like that. But what happened to Elizabeth Hodges in 1954 is the first recorded instance of a human being harmed by a falling object from space. this object about the size of your fist came down through her roof, bounced around inside her living room, and struck her on the leg. A bad bruise, certainly, but nothing anywhere near considered life-threatening at all.
Has it been recorded to have happened before or since?
No, there has not been a recorded instance of a meteorite striking a person. However, there was an anecdotal story about a dog, unfortunately, that may have gone to doggy heaven as a result of being struck by a meteorite, but there are no real records of that instance. I think it's just one of those apocryphal stories that goes around the astronomy community.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. With the Philadelphia Eagles tied for most wins in the NFL, fans across the region are taking care to practice their particular game rituals. Gianna DiMedio's father was a stickler for his, right up until his passing early in this year's magical season. She told his story and hers at a recent first-person arts event for WHYY's Common Space.
I'm going to talk about something that has, without a doubt, ravaged your emotions every single year. And that thing is the Philadelphia Eagles. Now, I know that I'll knock on wood and say my Hail Marys tonight because I know we're doing pretty damn well right now. But it has not always been easy being an Eagles fan, has it? My dad was one of their biggest fans. He would be very tactical about how he would go about his ways of being a fan. If he was at the stadium for a game that they lost, he wouldn't go back all season. If he was at home on his couch for a game that they won, then you could be sure that you were getting an RSVP of no to next week's birthday party, christening, or the rising of the dead from Elvis. He wasn't going. He needed to be in the exact spot that he was the week before. He took his moves to the churches, and he would check his wallet for the dollar bills that were minted in Philadelphia, and those were the ones that he would offer up to God at collection at Mass. My dad lived and breathed for Sundays in the fall. We all did. Friends and family poured through the door with their Eagles green and their Eagles jerseys on. And we'd gather in the living room for the coin toss. My dad would offer up his final plea to God for an Eagles win. And then it would be game time. And the progression of the quarters saw footballs flying down the field, profanities flying across the living room, compulsive hand waving, and then his superstition really took over. And he would pluck each one of us up and move us around the living room into a different seat because where we were sitting was affecting the defense. It's like it was his bat signal to God. And, you know, you just imagine God sitting around with the saints talking about war and poverty and famine. And he's like, oh, you know what? I got to go. Gary from Narstown is rearranging everybody. So it's getting really serious. We'll pick this up later, guys. But, you know, we didn't know if all his superstition and his spiritual ways about the Eagles really worked. But, you know, we went along with it. And we saw the holy grail of this in 2010 at the Miracle of the New Meadowlands game. But at this point, it's 8 minutes left in the game. The Eagles are down by 21 points. Half of the fan base has completely turned the game off. They're so disgusted by the birds. But not us. We have faith because my dad has made us believe. He said that you have to be willing to believe in your team. You have to believe that anything is possible. And that's what happened. We saw a game-changing play, and all of a sudden, we're doing the math. We're looking around at each other like, oh my God, the Eagles might do this. And then it happens. DeSean Jackson runs the ball back for a touchdown at the end of the game for an Eagles victory. We go nuts. We're running around screaming, chanting the Eagles fight song, finding ourselves in an interlocked hug in the middle of the living room. It was one of the best moments of my life that I will always remember. We lost my dad a couple months ago, and I haven't been able to watch the games the same way. But I've found my way back to the game, and my family are all texting each other saying, oh, get up, you know, change your seat. We got to do something to help the defense. And as I stand here before you, the Eagles are the best in the entire National Football League. So don't tell me it's coincidence that the year that my father has a direct line to the big guy in the sky, that the Eagles are doing the best they've done in decades. Now, we may never know the real reason for this, but I am willing to believe.
Gianna DiMedio is the media relations officer for Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. She says sharing her story makes her feel closer to her father, who she considered the master of all storytellers. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Tomorrow evening, we'll talk with Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Ronnie Polonesky about her investigative series on adults with intellectual disabilities and the systems that help care for them. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.